So good morning, everyone. I first want to thank the organizers for giving us a chance to talk about these results. So what I'm going to focus on in my talk today is a set of experiments in which we use light to initiate phase transitions in charge density wave systems. These are non-equilibrium or non-adiabatic type of phase transitions. So before I talk about them, let me just remind you how the equilibrium phase transitions and what is the typical picture we use to describe adiabatic phase transitions. So in a second order or a continuous phase transition, typically we just think of a diagram like this, where the system at high temperature is at some minima of the free energy. As you lower the temperature, you have this Mexican hat-like potential, and a finite order parameter develops, right? And if this is a second order phase transition, you have an order parameter picking up as a function of temperature like this. And if you have a probe that can measure the correlation length of the system, such as a diffraction or something, where the width of this would actually give you the width of the peak will give you the correlation length, you would see that right below the transition temperature, the correlation length is almost resolution limited. So the system, because it's cooled down adiabatically, can heal the any defects it has in the sample. So the question is, how would this picture change in a light-induced non-equilibrium phase transition? So one way to think about this is, these things typically happen very fast. We need large laser pulses, so and large field, so we typically use pulses. So if things happen very fast, one way you can connect to this is thinking about quenches, right? If you are quenching a system from high temperature to low temperature, meaning that you're cooling it so rapidly that you don't have enough, the system does not have enough chance to heal all these defects, then we kind of know what happens. The low temperature phase pops up in different regions of the sample, but they are not necessarily phase coherent. The defects form in between, topological defects form in between. So the intuition that people had in these light-induced phase transitions is that maybe the similar thing happens, that because these things happen very fast, the system does not have enough time to heal all of the defects, and maybe you have topological defects forming. Now, this was a nice theoretical intuition, but there wasn't really any solid experimental evidence for the existence of these. So this is one of the questions, but there's many, many others as well. I mean, typically our intuition tells us that when you shine light onto a system, you would be melting in order, going from like a low temperature state to a high temperature state. But a natural question to ask is, could you do the reverse? Could you shine light into a high temperature looking like thing and then make it more ordered? Can you generate more orders by shining light onto them? If there is phase competition in your system, two phases competing, is it possible that you can come with the light and help one of the phase over the other one? Many other things. I mean, can you actually engineer free energy diagrams? Okay, so to study all of these, we decided that we need a simple system. We don't want to choose the most complicated sample in the world. We want a system that we kind of understand most of the things. So we decided to focus on charge density waves. So just as a reminder, in a charge density wave, in the equilibrium phase transition, as you cool the thing down, when the charge density wave forms, you can probe it with diffraction. You can see that there's a nice order parameter forming up. You can the height of the satellite peak, the total intensity in the satellite peak is a good measure of this. And also, if you look at the width of the satellite peak, it's almost resolution limited, meaning that this transition is almost like a textbook case of the phase transition that we are used to. So what do we want to do? We want to take this system, and we want to basically perform an experiment with light. We want to shine light, melt this order, and then watch as this order melts and then comes back. And we want to ask, how is this similar or different from equilibrium phase transition? What are we going to probe? We can probe many things, but two things in particular. One of them, we're going to do time-resolved diffraction. So we are going to look at this satellite peak, which is a direct measure of the order parameter. And then we will also do time-resolved photoemission. We're going to look at the gap in the electronic density of states. And then we're going to see if from these two quantities, can we learn something about the phase transition. So in my talk, I'm going to basically talk about two different systems. In the first half of the talk, I'm going to be talking about rare earth tritellurides, in particular lanthanum tritelluride. And I'll show you how we can melt this charge density wave, how we can watch it from the lattice and from the electronic point of view. And on the way, we actually discovered something quite unexpected, that as we melt one charge density wave, a new one that does not exist in equilibrium forms in the system. And then in the last part of my talk, I'll tell you something else. We will actually look at this charge density wave, titanium diselenide, and I'll show you that by shining chiral light on it, we can actually induce a chiral gyrotropic order on this system. So anyways, let me just get started with the first part of my talk. So the people who did the work was my student Alfred Zong and my postdoc Ansul Koyar. So Ansul is actually setting up his own lab at UCLA right now. And this work would not be possible if we didn't have the sample and the collaboration with Ian Fisher. And my colleague Pablo Herrero helped us with the preparation of the samples, and some of the work was done at the Stanford UED facility. So let me just give you 1 minute background on these charge density wave systems. So rare earth tritellurides is a family of materials in which they display different charge density wave orders. Depending on the rare earth that you choose here, you have either one phase transition in which a charge density wave forms along the C direction. For some of these guys, where A and C are closer to each other, at a lower temperature, another charge density wave forms along the A direction. So here you have like a checkerboard, here you have a unidirectional charge density wave. Now, the specific material that we study is a lanthanum tritelluride. It's all the way on this side, and for this guy, there is only charge density wave along the C axis. There's no A axis charge density wave. So from this diagram only, you can see that these two orders are kind of competing. As the TC of the first charge density wave along the C direction goes down, the other one goes back up. So you can see that there's two competing orders. So this is what the structure looks like. And the important bands that result in this charge density wave are these coming from these Tellurian sheets. If you look into in the momentum space, these are like the tight binding kind of calculations. So you can see that there's this wave vector QC that nests these two bands. Obviously, you can also nest these guys, but this difference between A and C kind of makes it prefer the along the C direction. Okay, so with this intro, what are we going to do experimentally? So I'm going to come with the laser pulse, melt this order, and then come with an electron pulse and take snapshots of this diffraction, the structure, as this order melts and then comes back. Now, this is shown in reflection, but we actually do transmission. So here's our sample. When we put it on the electron diffraction chamber with no light present, we just do diffraction, regular diffraction first. You can see that the Bragg peaks, okay? And then you can also see these tiny peaks in between the Bragg peaks. Those are the satellite peaks coming from the charge density wave order. So let me take a cut here. You can see the Bragg peaks right here. And then in between, these are the charge density wave peaks. Now, right here is a weakly allowed Bragg peak. So now I'm going to hit with light, and I'm going to play you a movie. So this particular snapshot is 1.3 picosecond before the light hits. Now we can see as the light hits this system, you're losing the charge density wave peaks because the order is melting. And as it comes back, as the order comes back, the intensity of these peaks are coming back, right? I can analyze this movie in the following way. I can take the total intensity of these satellite peaks and the Bragg peaks, and then I can compare them. So here's that plot. So this is the satellite peak. You can see it starts from 100%, goes all the way down to about 10% in about a picosecond or so. And as I wait long enough, 10, 15 picosecond, it's relaxing back, right? Now, this is good. This is telling me that I'm almost melting this order. As I will show you in a second, if I crank up the intensity of my laser beam, I can completely get this down to zero, okay? Now, the other thing that I can see from here is that the intensity of the Bragg peak is only changing 1 or 2%, not a big change. So, in fact, nothing is really happening to the lattice structure. This is not an irreversible change or anything. We are mainly melting this charge density wave order, and we can see the manifestation in both channels. Now, the other surprising thing is that the Bragg peak intensity is first going up. So this is surprising because normally when you dump energy into the lattice, there's more phonons around, and these phonons give rise to the Debye-Valar factor, and then intensity normally goes down. In fact, this is what happens here at the later times. So this is the Debye-Valar factor. But the reason why it's going up first is because you remove this extra modulation in the lattice, so the lattice itself becomes more ordered in a sense, and that's really what you're seeing here. So as the heating kicks in, then you're losing intensity in the Bragg peak as well. So this is the first observation. You know, we are melting disorder, therefore we are losing the intensity. The other thing that we can see is that if I look at the profile of the satellite spot at different times, for example, here I have a resolution limited Bragg satellite peak. Right here at the peak of this chart, the maxima of this curve, the minima, you can see that I've lost intensity, that's what we are plotting here, but also this thing becomes more broad. And as I go to longer times, it recovers back. So one way to understand this is the width is inversely proportional to the correlation length. What this must be telling me is that not only that I'm losing the amplitude of this charge density wave order, but because it's getting broader here, it really means that the correlation length is also decreasing in real space. So I can do this experiment at different laser fluences, at different pump fluences, and this is what this plot is showing. So the red is the highest fluence, blue is the smallest fluence. So for these fluences, you can see that I exactly kill the order, so it goes from 100% to 0%, but then it recovers, right? What we are seeing is that for different fluences, the recovery is somewhat different, so it's slower for higher fluences and faster for lower fluences. That's interesting. But the other thing that I want to point your attention to is the following. If I pick two of these fluences, and if I take these curves, this is the total intensity. The solid curves are exactly these curves, total intensity, integrated intensity of the satellite peak as a function of time. And on top, if I plot 1 over the width of this spot, so which is the correlation length in real space, those are these symbols, right? So what you can see is that somehow the time dependence of the correlation length is exactly tracking the time dependence of the total intensity of the spot. Now, these are normally two independent parameters. One of them is the total intensity, the other one is the width. So there is really no reason for them to be tracking each other. The fact that they do really tells us that it must be that the same physical mechanism responsible for both. And our hypothesis is that what's really happening when you hit with the light, you are actually putting on these defects into the charge density wave. This kind of a defect, by definition, at the defect core, the order, the amplitude of the order goes exactly to zero, so you're definitely decreasing the amplitude of the order, but also the correlation length will also be decreased because this is kind of the mean distance between these defects. So we think that this kind of a thing can explain both of these scenarios. Now, I should also mention that in a recent experiment done with STM, if you chemically dope these materials, it was observed that if you look at the charge density wave, you know, these kind of defects are formed because of the chemical doping. So in a sense, light excitation is kind of mimicking this kind of chemical doping. So everything that I've told you so far is really doing diffraction, which is probing the structure. A natural question would be, how are the electrons reacting to this laser melting of the charge density wave? So what we are going to do now, we are going to try to probe exactly the same thing from the electronic side. So the way to do this is to do photoemission. So we are going to kick with the light, melt this order, and in the meantime, we're going to perform photoemission. But to actually get the interesting point into the momentum space, you need high wave vectors. So you really need to go to high photon energies. And we do this in my lab by generating higher harmonics of our laser. We can run it, for example, the ninth harmonic at 11 eV or at something like 19th harmonic around 30 eV or so. So for this experiment, we use this one, 11 eV laser pulse. And in our setup, we use a time of flight detector, which allows us not just to see a cut through the momentum space, but an entire region. So if with this time of flight detector, when we position it right, we can, for example, see this entire area of the Fermi surface. So these are the bands that we are interested in. And in this material, it's not fully gapped. Some parts are gapped, some parts are not gapped. And this is what we see in our spectrum. So you can see that these bands, experimentally observed bands, kind of track very nicely what you expect. Now, I'm cheating a little because I'm actually showing you these bands about 300 femtoseconds after laser kicks the sample. The reason why I'm showing you after is because if I showed you before, which is this one, you don't see much because there is the charge density wave gap opening up at the Fermi surface already. So now let me show you a movie. So this is 700 femtoseconds before laser pulse hits. If you wish, this is the equilibrium bend structure at the Fermi surface showing you that there's a charge density wave gap. But now, after you kick with the light, you melt the gap, or you fill it in, and then you can see that these bends are there. One more time here. So, and then if you go to longer times, the gap reopens back, and then you recover back the equilibrium state. So now let me actually show you cuts from here. So this is a gapped region of the Fermi surface here. There's the gap, charge density wave gap. If you kick with the light, then you actually see that the gap is gone, either filled in or closes. And then if you wait long enough, it reopens back. So I can kind of characterize the time dependence of this gap by momentum integrating and then plotting the intensity within the gap. And this is what I get. So these are three different laser fluences. And then for those three different fluences, I'm basically plotting how quickly does this gap closes and reopens back, right? Now, one immediate thing you can see is that after about a picosecond or two, the gap reopens back. As opposed to, if you remember, in the electron diffraction experiment, sometimes at the higher fluences, it took about 10, 15 picoseconds for the satellite intensity to recover back. So let me actually put these two side by side. So this is a number of different pump fluences. This is three of them. And you can see that for higher fluences, this would take about 15 picoseconds. This one is fast. In fact, I can take the lifetime of these curves. That's this one here. This is fitting an exponential to each one of them and plotting this recovery time as a function of the pump fluence. You can see that it linearly increases. That's kind of what we see from here by eye as well. But the most important thing is that if I do the same thing in here for these three different fluences, these are three of these white squares, there's a big difference. There's a factor of two or three difference right here. Now, these green squares are, if you do the optical pump probe experiment, we see exactly the same thing with as the ARPES. So the electronic dynamics can either be probed by ARPES or with optics, and they're consistent with each other. But right now, there is some inconsistency between these two experiments. We see fast dynamics here if you look at the gap, but we see slower dynamics if you look at the satellite spot. Now, another piece of the puzzle is that we also see that the width of the peak increases and then recovers back. So not only the amplitude goes down, but also the width. But we believe there's actually a nice way to understand these, all of these observations, and that's the following. So right after we hit with the light, two things are actually happening. One of them is that the light is actually reducing the amplitude of the order parameter that we are showing here as the fading of the color. But the other thing the light is doing is actually putting in these defects into the charge density wave. Now, what ARPES measures, it directly measures this local amplitude, local value of the amplitude of the order. So we can see in ARPES that this is actually back in about a picosecond or two experimentally. So as we are showing, the color is coming back here. Now, what the electron diffraction measures, it actually measures the total diffracted intensity right here. And for this to recover, not only the amplitude has to recover, but also the long-range phase coherence has to recover. So basically, our experiment is saying that the recovery of the amplitude is very fast, in about a picosecond or so, but the recovery of the long-range phase coherence is slow, and that kind of makes sense because it is slow because it has to wait for these defects to heal, right? So this slow time scale that we observe is really the recovery of these defects. Okay, so now the other thing that I can say about this is another way of saying that I'm actually quenching this order, because what I'm saying is that amplitude is recovering very fast, but the phase long-range phase coherence does not. So it's another way of saying that this order is quenched. Anytime you quench something, it's also a possibility that the system can explore part of the free energy diagram that it normally does not go in thermal equilibrium. So let me remind you that in this phase diagram of these rare earth tritellurides, there was this other charge density wave For lanthanum tritelluride, this does not exist. If you cool it down, you never go to this phase. Right, so it is there in these other guys, because this wave vector also nicely nests this other one. And in particular, for example, if you look at this guy, dysprosium, and if you do some kind of a X-ray experiment to look at the softening of the phonon, you can see that along the C-axis, a phonon softens nicely and hits zero, just like you would expect in a charge density wave. You know, another phonon at exactly the same vector along the A-axis is also trying to soften, but it actually loses the competition and it recovers back. It only, this thing goes to charge density wave at a much lower temperature in the A-axis. So the point is that competition of between A and C-axis order can also be seen in this X-ray experiment. So now let me actually show you what we observe in our experiment in the time result case. So this is the static electron diffraction from lanthanum tritelluride. It shows you that there's a modulation along the C-axis, but there's absolutely nothing along the A-axis. Okay? So this is before we hit with the light. Now let me show you what happens after. So maybe you can concentrate right here. So this is after, right here. So you can see the two spots, so before, after. So right after you kick with the light, you also make the system develop another modulation along the A-axis. So in fact, I can show you a movie. So here, looking at this cut here, you can see that there's nothing in the A-axis direction. As I kick with the light, you know, peaks appear and then disappear along the A-axis. So another way to visualize this is take the same area and then look side by side. This is like mirror image of this area. You can clearly see that the two peaks actually develops there. We can look at the time dependence. As we weaken one of the order along the C-axis, the other one along the A-axis develops. In fact, the rise time of this order is a bit longer. It kind of has to wait until this one is dead or weakened, but then the recovery is actually very similar to each other. So we can also get the recovery of the thermal diffuse scattering as the heat is deposited into the system. Then more and more phonons are around, and the electrons are inelastically scattered to in between the Bragg peaks, and that allows us to actually measure this as well. So if you do this experiment at different laser fluences, so this is what we see. For higher fluence, we destroy more and more of this C-axis order, and then A-axis shows up. But the important point is that the recovery is identical. So if I can fit this curve and this curve with the same time constant, right? What does this tell me? It basically tells me that the fact that the recovery is identical, it basically reconfirms our picture that as you put in these defects with light, you basically destroy this C-axis order at the defect core. Because these two orders are competing, when you destroy this guy, then the other guy can form. And going away, going back to the equilibrium is kind of controlled by how these defects heal. Okay. So this is the picture. So light puts in one of these defects. And then at this defect core, you destroy the C-axis order parameter, but these two are competing, so the other guy forms. And because the other guy forms, you can actually see as the defects heal, the system goes back to the equilibrium. So in my last 5 minutes, I want to give you one other example of this light-induced phase transition. This is a bit different because this is not done with pulses, but this is rather done with CW light, continuous wave light. And this work was done by two of our postdocs, Su Yang Zhu and Chong Ma, and it was in close collaboration with Pablo Herrera Herrera. So now, before I do this, let me just give you like a 30-second intro. So what is gyrotropic order? Well, we know that if you think about liquid crystals, there's the isotropic liquid crystals. If you break rotation symmetry, we get pneumatic order, pneumatically ordered. And we have quantum analog of this pneumatic state. Now, similarly, in liquid crystals, if you break inversion, mirror, and all the roto-inversion symmetries, you can actually make a chiral liquid crystal called cholesteric liquid crystal. The question is there a quantum analog to this? Is there a system where, electrons, spontaneously develop a chiral order? Obviously, I'm not talking about chiral structures, they exist. I'm talking about electrons developing a chiral order in an achiral structure. So the system is titanium diselenide. This is a charge density wave material. In the normal state, this is inversion symmetric, therefore it's not chiral, okay? When you go to the charge density wave phase, this thing, basically, it's like a semi-metal, so there's a gamma point, L point, there's a vector that connects them, there's three inequivalent L points, it can form three different charge density waves at 120 degrees to each other. So if you look with X-ray, we did our on our own sample, you see that there's a nice charge density wave forming below 200 Kelvin. Now, there was an earlier XTM experiment in which they looked at this sample, titanium diselenide, they found two domains, okay? And it was shown that in these two different domains, the intensity of these three different charge density wave vectors, you know, it goes either left-handed or right-handed in the following set. This is like, this is the strongest here, maybe the weaker one, and then the Q3 was the weakest, so it's kind of rotating this way. The other domain was the other way. What this STM paper said is that perhaps this is indicating that this is some kind of a chiral arrangement of these three different charge density wave orders in different planes. But there was another XTM paper that was published afterwards, which claimed that this is not chiral, it's actually achiral. This can be explained by something else, by looking at the step edges. They argued that this is not the case. So, and similarly, there was X-ray that kind of, wasn't really necessarily, resolving this debate. So there's a nice way to look for this in optics, and that's the following. So if you have a sample, and if you study the following effect, if you shine circularly polarized light, okay, and look for a current that's along the wave vector of the light, okay? So this is called circular photogalvanic effect. And if your sample is not chiral, if you think about the mirror image of this experiment, left circularly polarized goes to right circularly polarized, your sample is the same, it's not chiral, the current is the same, you can see that in a sample that's not chiral, left circularly polarized and right circularly polarized cannot be different. The current will be the same. There will not be a difference. But if your sample is chiral, okay, you can actually show that you can't use this argument. So this difference between left circularly polarized light and right circularly polarized light becomes symmetry allowed. So if you see a difference in the current by shining left and right circularly polarized light, that is actually a good probe of the chirality. So this is what we did. We shine laser onto this material. We have electrodes here, and then we cool the sample below. So this is above. We don't really see a difference between left circular and right circular polarized light. This is the same thing. We cool below, and then we do the measurement again, and we don't see much either. Okay. So we, at first, we said maybe this is not chiral, but then we realized if there is really two domains, they will cancel each other, right? If they are equally populated, right? So the question is, how can you align the domains of one chirality? Well, if this was a magnet, you would just put on a magnetic field. Well, this is not a magnet. You can't really do this with a magnetic field. We decided to try it with light. So what we did is we cooled the sample in the presence of circularly polarized light, okay? Shining left circularly polarized light, cooling the system while this light is on, and do the same measurement. And then what we saw was that when you do this, when you cool it in the presence of light, there is indeed a big difference between left circular polarized and right circular polarized light. If you now warm up the system, you actually lose this effect right around TC, a little lower, I'll show you. Now, if you repeat the same experiment with right circularly polarized light, you see the same effect, but the phase is inverted. So you basically align to the other domain. So this is left-handed versus right-handed. So I'm running out of time. Let me just finish here. So this thing, chirality, really picks up at a different, slightly lower temperature. So this is, the TC is around 200, this is about 175. So we have a way to understand this, thanks to our theory collaborators. We have a way to understand this from the free energy diagram. So what we are really thinking of, there's a term in the system, you can write it like this. Basically, this is going to be positive for right circular polarized light and negative for the left circular polarized light. And this will only be there if the system has chirality. And this constant lambda is basically kind of characterizing the chirality-dependent light-matter interaction, it actually can be calculated from the theory. And our theory collaborators calculated this, as well as its dependence on the photon energy, and we can test it, and it actually agrees well with our experiment. So with here, with this, let me conclude and leave you with the picture of my group. Thank you for your attention.
A quick question. So, sorry, in the last bit, did you say that the chiral domains, the chirality is created by the light, or could I imagine that?
No, we don't think so. We think the chirality is already there. Light is just ordering them.
They're ordering them. That's what you think.
That's what we.
Could it be the opposite? Could it be that the light is actually creating a chiral CDW?
I mean, I guess in principle it can be, but I don't think we have evidence that that is the case.
Could you tell the difference?
Could we really tell the difference? I think it will be hard from our experiment.
Fabulous talk, Nir. I had a quick question about the idea that you described about shining the circularly polarized light and then effectively making the system with single domain. It implies that the light acts like a magnetic field on a ferromagnet.
Yes.
That's the argument that you made.
Yes.
Does that mean that you see a kind of susceptibility as well at temperatures above TC?
Could you see that there may be some chiral fluctuations above TC? Is that what you're saying?
Well, you should, in principle, if that's what's happening, and it should couple linearly to the order parameter, and therefore it should have a diverging susceptibility at the transition.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see evidence of that?
No, we didn't really look very clearly there, but from your point about light behaving like a magnetic field, it's absolutely right. So you can actually see that in other systems, light was used to align magnetic domains. So it does indeed act almost exactly like a magnetic field in this sense, right? You can use circular polarized light to align magnetic domains as well. So, and in fact, there, people were thinking about a term in the Fermi, in the free energy like this, where this would only be there if the sample is magnetic. So, my intuition tells me that anything that can be applied to here will also be here. So, it is another interesting direction to look for right above TC. We haven't done.
So, regarding titanium diselenide, I'm just trying to understand the experiment with measuring current.
Sure.
So, a lot of the titanium diselenide is actually quite metallic, right, at low temperatures.
Right.
So does that make a difference for the measurement or not?
In what sense? It is metallic, yes, but...
It affects the band structure, this picture of the...
It does make a difference in... if I show you the band structure of the titanium diselenide, so it's like this. So our light energy is, this is in the charge density wave phase, there's a gap that opens up. And the specific photon energy that we choose is kind of very near to that. So if you go to the higher photon energies, we see that this effect actually goes down. Right? I mean, we do also need to tune the thickness of the sample such that, our light can go through. It is indeed very metallic, right? If you have a thicker sample, then the light would not be able to go through.
Okay.
In that sense, it does.
Okay, we can talk later.
Yes.
So at the beginning, you were talking about melting the charge density wave, and you saw an increase of the structural Bragg peaks that are commensurate.
Yes.
I was trying to reconcile that with when you were talking about the A-axis CDW.
That's
so
right.
Could you come back to that and just...
Yes.
I was just wondering, are those two things happening at the same time? I was having a hard time understanding how that's sort of restoring the order of the system if it's also creating a charge density wave along the other direction.
Right. Yes, those two things do happen at the same time. As I'm kicking with one light beam, I am the regular Bragg peak increases tiny bit, and the C-axis is weakened, and a new order shows up in the A direction, right? But this is a very interesting question as well. I mean, if you looked at one of the materials that had two orders at the same time, C and A, right? And if you kick with light, the light would decrease both of the order parameters, but at the same time, as one of them goes down, the other one wants to come back up. So I think that, you know, so we haven't done that experiment. That's one of the, on our agenda as well. There's many different, you know, rich dynamics you can you know, measure and play with light as well.
Okay. As a related question, I was wondering whether you can calculate how much that peak, that commensurate peak, should increase while you start to melt these charge density weights.
Yes, and you could, and that's kind of in the right bulk.
It is what you get.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
So related question. So you can create the A-axis CDW after photo excitation, and you can see clearly see by the diffraction, right?
Yes.
So can you see the such effect in your Fermi surface data?
Yes, that's a very good question. So we in our resolution we couldn't. Like for example, if I understand the question right, can you look with the ARPES and see that a new gap is opening in the yeah? So we didn't really see that. I mean, but it could be that our resolution is not good enough. Now, what we did is we looked at erbium tritelluride, which has two gaps, A and B, right? What we saw was that the time dependence of these two gaps are different, are not the same. And that probably is coming from this kind of competition between the two.
Right? So you can find some different material.
Yes, exactly.
All right, well, let's thank Nu again.